Welcome once more to Telling Tales, a programme for writers and storytellers. I'm Brendan Nolan. We have a special guest here today, Paddy Kelly. We're going to chat to Paddy. I was going to call you a novelist, but you're much more than that. You're in anyway with your third book is in the shops now, The American Way. It's the third part of a series. So how's that going for you, Paddy?
It's going well so far, yeah. Brendan. Thank you. It just came off the press actually last week. It's just in the shops yesterday, and the launch is next Thursday at the Pygmalion in the Powers Court. At 7 o'clock, of course, everybody's welcome.
Okay, all right. And so it's part of a series anyway. So where does this fit into the series that you're writing?
This would be the third book.
Yeah.
They are not sequential, the books, but they are all incidences in the 20th century demonstrating the intimate relationship between organized crime and politics in America.
Okay, so where does this one fit into it then?
This takes place in 1912. It's set in a town just north of Boston called Lawrence, Massachusetts, and it centers around a very, very big strike by about 57,000 immigrants, 45 different languages, all kinds of religions. They couldn't communicate. Less than 10% of them spoke English, and they struck against one of the richest men in the world, J.P. Morgan.
Okay, and how did that work out for them?
It worked out well. The reason I wrote the story was it's the one actual clear victory that the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, also known as the Wobblies, actually struck against the political system in America. Of course, they paid for it. When Wilson came into office, he more or less put the death penalty on the three leaders.
Yeah.
And one went to prison, two escaped to Russia. And they are actually today only two Americans buried in the Kremlin wall.
All right. Is your man Reed, not the journalist?
John Reed, exactly. Yeah. Jack Reed, and as well as another guy called Big Bill Hayward. He was the actual leader. And Jack Reed, although a member of the IWW, wasn't really a leader, but he was their primary journalist who wrote about them.
Yeah. But they made a film about that, was it?
Reds. Incredible film, yeah. Yeah. Warren Beatty actually paid for it out of his own pocket because nobody in America would make it. And it was quite a spectacular film, very historically accurate.
Yeah.
And it showed his relationship with Louise Bryant, the writer as well, writer and poet.
Yeah. Was it a success? Did people go to see it in America?
It was both a critical and a financial success. They didn't put millions and millions in the bank, but they did pay for the movie. That makes it a success. And, of course, it was a critically acclaimed film.
Yeah. So how are you doing yourself with screenplays or screenwriting? Or have any of your earlier books been turned into this series been optioned or anything?
Actually, yeah, Underworld was optioned for 1 year, but it is quite a big story, of course. The money couldn't come through.
Yeah.
This one, actually, American Way, the idea for it was actually optioned 2 years ago before the book came out as a BBC production. But again, that never transpired. So it was optioned for 2 years, actually.
Yeah.
There was an option for a year, then it was renewed. And it wanted to center on one of the characters, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who both parents came from Ireland. She born and raised in New York, and she was a radical labor leader in New York her whole life.
Where did her parents come from?
Cork and Galway, the two of them. And both of them had grandparents executed by the British, so they were radically politically active.
Mm.
And which, of course, they raised her radically politically active as well.
Do you know what period the parents went to America in?
Well, she was born turn of the century, let's see, around 1898, I think, and so they would have probably come in the 40s. No, more later, probably the 50s, late 50s, early 60s, I'd say.
Sometime around the time Kennedy was gone from Wexford.
That sounds about right, yeah.
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 Funny that, isn't it?
Like yeah, it's
one
it's amazing.
Capitalism and the other one into...
That's it, yeah, the radical socialism. But
socialism. One
interesting aspect that really drew me to the story is that in this story, and a lot of people out there might not enjoy this, but in this story, the Irish are the bad guys.
All right.
Because they are actually the third generation of Irish, and they've established themselves in the political machine. They literally owned the police force. At this time, it was against the law. It's still in America. It's against the law to use the military against the people, the citizens. So they cleverly created a thing called a militia, which essentially was a branch of the United States Army. And they used a militia against these people, against these strikers, to subdue them. So,
all right. Well, who were the troopers in the state? Who shot the students at Kent University in the 60s or whatever it was?
National Guard. Yeah. So what became what was the military?
Part of the military? No.
Yes and no. Again, this is to escape posse comitatus. Sorry, posse comitatus is the law, 1878, and they were National Guard, and they are the children, the bastard children of the militia. So the militia was converted after the first war into the National Guard.
Mm.
Yeah, those are the people that shot the students at Kent State.
So are these books, these are novelizations, are they?
They're novelizations, they're technically historical fiction. There is one, in this particular story, there is one or two fictional characters. We follow a guy called Michael Casabori, who comes from a small town outside Palermo, which is where my mother came from. And he goes to America for the golden dream, et cetera, et cetera. And when he gets there, he doesn't realize that this this sort of volcano is about to erupt between labor and the government. Because, for example, these people have been working for the last 9 years in the story with not only not having a pay raise, but they had their pay lowered twice in the last 7 to 8 years. And so they're kind of getting sick of it. Okay. And so they go on strike. And they're led by Joseph Iter and a guy named Giovanetti. And they're both from New York. They're both IWW leaders. And they go up to Massachusetts, and they kind of help organize. And the people go on strike. At that point, it blows up.
Yeah.
It blows up at 12 noon on January 12th in
1912. During that period around 1912, 13, all the rest of it, and then on into 1917, there was a lot of labor unrest right around the world.
It was
here in Ireland, and anyway, lockout and all the rest.
Larkin came.
So the Russian Revolution in 17.
That's right. Yeah, that whole period was. I look at it as the time that the actual people, what would be called the proletariat by the communists, were sick of royalties and monarchs, and so they kind of revolted. That was the end of World War II. Marked the end of royalty, more or less, in terms of power. They had to come to grips with the power of the industrialists, and they needed the industrialists to stay in power. So just like around the turn of the 13th century, 14th century, when we had the guilds. The guilds were the first people who had money outside of the royalty and the church, and so society split. We saw that again in the First War, you know.
Do you see any parallels with the current situation now in Wall Street?
The protests on Wall Street, this is exactly what was happening in 1910, 1911, 1912. The strikes against the major capitalists, the car industry, the steel industry, these kind of things, the banking industry, you know, same thing.
Do you see it going anywhere, or will it fizzle out?
I'm very, very, very afraid that it will fizzle out, but I pray that it doesn't. I really hope it doesn't. There's lots of momentum. I hope they keep the momentum. The problem is with age balance. It depends on the country. Are there older people or younger people? You know, the younger people have the gumption and the energy to get out there and do it, and the older people are sort of settled and they don't want to be disrupted. You know, the same prior to World War II. You know, the older people in Europe didn't want to accept, you know, that Hitler wanted to conquer the world. They didn't want to be disrupted and pried out of their easy chairs. So
it depends on what the state does or the rulers do. And the rulers in this country told the people over 70 they couldn't have a medical card, and all of a sudden they were back out in the streets. And there were all the radicals of the 60s back out again.
That was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And on the same day they met their grandchildren coming the other way as students protesting. So
that's exactly, yes.
Is it possible those things could converge?
It's possible. Yeah, again, I'd love to see it. Love to see it.
Yeah.
You know, the police, I don't know what happened this morning, but the police were supposed to forcibly evict the people on Wall Street that are protesting. And at the same time, I think they coordinated with Britain, in my opinion, but I'm not saying it's a conspiracy, but they also coincidentally, at the same time, you know, tried to get rid of the kids in front of St. Paul's there over in London.
Yeah.
So we'll see what
crackdown is in Dame Street, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
America one day, Britain the next, then.
Yeah.
Dame Street the next day. Hey. Go home.
But no, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what this book deals with, all of that sort of unrest. You know, people talk about anarchists, the anarchist movement, that sort of thing. This is where it originated. You know, and again, I'm not advocating it, but the point is this is where it originated. When these foreigners, Eastern Europeans, Italians, Jews, went to America, you know, and the Irish were all there, and the British as well, Scots, they said, get out of here. We don't want you here. And, you know, so conflict was inevitable.
How long did it take you to write this one?
This one was pretty good. This one I knocked out in 7 months. But there was on and off research for a year, year and a half before I wrote it.
Yeah.
A lot of historical details, names, places, dates, et cetera, et cetera.
How do you control your research? When you start to research, control yourself from going down side lanes and following interest in little tidbits and stuff like that.
That's a great question. I appreciate that. And it is difficult. And I do go off on safari sometimes. You don't get lost. But
safari.
Yeah.
That's a great expression. Yeah. You went on safari.
I do, yeah. I am very well organized. I have an undergraduate degree in zoology, and so I use that for organization. You know, never did a thing in my life with zoology, but it's great help for organizational ability. So I keep detailed journals and notes and categorize things. You know, find details. And
you want to be a good researcher, take a degree in zoology, is it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's you have an actual class in, you know, research and writing papers and those sorts of things. So it comes in handy.
Okay, all right. But most people will write a book or try to keep the same characters or whatever it is, but you're following a sequence here. So how much of it are you meeting older characters that were young in your first books?
Good question. I'm actually in the first book. There are characters there who were younger that are now in this book. And then there will be characters in the next book who are a little bit older.
Yeah.
So it's out of sequence. It's non-sequential. Yeah. And the stories are separate. Again, I emphasize, you don't need to read them in sequence.
I'm not suggesting that.
But I appreciate the question. Like I said, in this one, there are characters who are much younger in the first book.
Yeah. It's like people who write in sagas. They have to start off with somebody quite young, and then by the end of the book, they have to be the grandparent or the great-grandparent.
That's it, yeah. I did think about that when I started the series, and when I laid it out, and I didn't want to be sequential in the people's lives purposely, yeah.
So what's the fourth one in the trilogy, then?
The fourth one in the trilogy. The tetralogy, that's a good
one. What are we calling it? What's the fourth?
Tetralogy.
Tetralogy, right? Go on. Okay, yep.
The last one is The Broad in the Kimono. And it centers on...
The Broad in the Kimono.
Yeah, that's a line from a film, from a noir film, which was banned by Congress in 1944.
Okay.
And it centers on the battle of the nearly all Jewish Hollywood against the nearly all WASP Congress during and after the Second War. Yeah, there was a huge, huge battle there.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers and all those guys. Well, Jack Warner primarily, the blacklisting. But it's not, again, it's not about McCarthy and all that stuff. This is prior. This is the platform that McCarthy used to establish his terror and rampage through the halls of Congress. This is the origins of this sort of thing. My PhD dissertation was on film noir, and so this kind of centers. Film noir were the one film genre that the Congress really attacked with a vehemence. You know, they wanted to ban it completely. And there were some interesting actions between Hollywood and Congress.
Why did they want to ban film noir?
There was a code. It was established in the 20s, largely due to Mae West and people like her. She would appear with very flimsy blouses, etc. The Hays Code. Well, prior to the Hays Code, there was, I don't remember the name of the code, but it was actually established by Congress, and they appointed an Irish priest to set the code. And in the 1920s, he was surprisingly liberal. I'll give him credit for that. He only had three rules. Yeah. One was that no overt sexual nudity or profanity. One is that the bad guy always had to come to a bad end commensurate with how bad he was. And you could never show cops, judges, and officials as bad guys.
All right.
So that was the original code. It was very basic.
True to life, then.
True to life, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Historically accurate. But then came the Hays Code. They revised it in the 30s, and the Hays Code, and that was taken over. And, these films, they began in 1942 is officially the first one, is what's the one with the Maltese Falcon. That's officially the first noir film. And then they ended in 1958 with Touch of Evil. So that was the last film noir, officially. Anything you see after that is more or less neo-noir, like Chinatown. But anyway, they snubbed the code.
Yeah.
Okay, they started showing cops and officials as bad guys. Okay, and Congress were incensed at this. And especially Hoover. Hoover went after them. You know, Hoover, you know, ate any kind of difference of the government, like breakfast food.
Yes.
He lived on it. So he went after them with a vehemence as well.
The Maltese Falcon was a book first by Dashiell Hammett, wasn't it?
It was a book by Dashiell Hammett in 1932-33, and they did make a film in 1936, was an absolute abortion.
Yeah.
It was basically a piss take on the book.
Okay.
It failed miserably.
Yeah.
And then Warner revised it, and Bogey got the part, and pretty well launched his career.
I've been rereading Dashiell Hammett for myself recently, and I'm struck by the quality of his writing.
Dashiell Hammett is actually in The American Way. He's mentioned. He was a Pinkerton agent who they were used to subvert a lot of people.
Yeah.
In 1915, he was asked to assassinate an IWW leader.
Right.
Okay, he refused, and that's when he quit the Pinkertons, became a writer.
Okay.
So that's his background.
Yeah. But anyone listening that wants to see good or read good writing, apart from our author here, Dashiell Hammett's writing is very good. If you're a beginner writer, his descriptions of even simple street scenes is fantastic.
I would additionally recommend Ray Chandler, who actually used Dashiell Hammett as a mentor.
Did he?
Yeah, well, Ray Chandler wrote the screenplay for The Maltese Falcon.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
As well as his own novels.
No.
Raymond Chandler wrote novels.
Oh, yeah. He was a well-established novel. He was probably the leader of noir in his period, in his life. But, yeah, he was influenced by Hammett. He actually said Hammett took crime where it belonged. Like Agatha Christie, he said, had it in the parlor, and Deschelham took it out of the parlor and put it back where it belonged, in the street.
So he did a great job.
But I have his collected letters, which I would all highly recommend to read.
Ray Chandler's
collected letters, and his books.
Okie doke. Well, that's the name of the book anyway, is The American Way, which is your latest work.
That's right.
It's going to be launched next Thursday. Tell us again where it's going to be.
Thursday at Pygmalion's in the Powers Court.
Okay.
And that's at 7 o'clock. We got wine, women, song, music.
Will the broad in the kimono be there or not?
We'll see what happens, yeah. I'll give her a ring. See if she'll fly in for us.
We can only look forward to it. We'll see you anyway the next time, Paddy, and I wish you well with your fourth book in the trilogy when you come in.
Brendan, I appreciate you having me. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much. This week's story is The Curious Girl, and it's told to us now by Kate Corkery.
Once upon a time, long time ago, there was a very clever girl. She was always asking questions, as clever people often do. One day, she spotted her grandmother sitting down by the river with a lump of wood in one hand and a chisel in the other. She was carving a statue. The little girl said, "Granny, what are you doing?" "Oh, I'm carving a statue of a very famous Irish hero," said the granny. "Oh, well, who's that?" "He's called Finn McCool. Have you never heard of Finn McCool?" "Yes," said the girl. "But, granny, why is he sucking his thumb like a baby? He doesn't look like a big hero. He's sucking his thumb." "Ah," said the granny. "Did you never hear why Finn McCool sucked his thumb? He sucked his thumb because of the day when he was walking by a river just like this one here, and he came upon a man fishing. That old man, his name was Finnegas. He had been fishing at that spot in that river for years and years and years, because he was waiting and hoping and praying that one day he would catch a very special salmon. That was the salmon of knowledge covered in red spots, and anyone who would eat that salmon would know everything." Well, the little boy, Finn McCool, he was a boy at the time, he was there when Finnegas pulled the salmon out of the water, and he was so excited he couldn't even cook it. So he called the boy to come and make a fire, cook the fish while he went into the woods to pray. And Finn McCool, like yourself, he was a good boy. He did what he was told, and he made the fire. But somehow or other, the way he put the spit through the fish, didn't it snap? And it was falling into the flames. That very special fish was about to burn. So bravely he pulled the fish out of the flames, but in doing so, a piece of its skin stuck to his thumb. He stuck his thumb in his mouth and sucked it. And as soon as he tasted the flesh of that salmon, his eyes began to sparkle. His head began to spin with all the knowledge of the world that was flowing into it. And from that time on, all Finn McCool ever had to do was to suck his thumb if he wanted to know anything. "I want to catch a salmon like that, Granny. I want to know everything. Where can I get one?" "Oh," said the granny, laughing, "no, no, no, no. Asher, that's just a story. And anyway, you couldn't catch one." "Why not, Granny? Why couldn't I catch a fish?" "Well, you see, the legend says that if a girl eats the salmon of knowledge, she won't live to tell the tale." "What? You mean, if a girl eats the salmon of knowledge, she won't live to tell the tale, but if a boy eats the salmon, he'll know everything? Is that fair?"
"Well, I don't think it's fair," said the granny, "but that's what they say, and therefore I wouldn't even try if I were you. I don't think there are any left anyway," said the granny, "and if there was one at all left, it probably would be at the bottom of an old stone well way up in the town of Ossory. Too far away from here, too far for you to go, and you're too young."
The granny was still talking when the girl was tiptoeing away and turning her face towards Ossory, the well in the town of Ossory. Well, she ran down the road, and as she ran, she watched out for rowan berries, because she had heard tell that that salmon liked to eat rowan berries, and she picked as many as she could on the way, and she filled her pockets full. And when she got to the town of Ossory, long way away, she saw some children sitting under a tree, and she asked them where the well was, and they pointed to a little boreen that she followed. She walked down this little laneway, and when she got to the bottom of it, it wasn't a well she found down there. It was full of hungry pigs, and they thought she had come to feed them with the berries. They went to chase her. She ran up that muddy laneway, back up into the little village, and asked an old man, "Please, old man, can you tell me where the well is, the old stone well?" The old man pointed to a hill, told her to go up another little laneway. Well, she went up the little path up the hill, and it wound around. By now it was getting late in the day, and the golden sun was setting. And when she arrived, yes, there was an old, old well, an old stone well covered in moss, and the water in the well was very dark and very deep. She put her hand in her pocket. She only had 3 berries left, but she picked one and popped it in the water. She saw something move way down deep in the water. She saw the shape of a fish moving. She put another berry in the water. Now she could see the fish move towards the surface. And when she put the 3rd berry in, the fish put his head above the water, opened his mouth and went to eat the 1st berry. This fish was covered in spots. She put her hands out, ready to catch the fish as it swam towards her and ate the 2nd berry. When it opened its mouth to eat the 3rd berry, she caught it. Between the palms of her hands, she caught it, and it slipped, and it leapt up in the air, and it leapt over and back, and it flipped and it flopped on the grass, until finally it stopped still. And there it was, a salmon of knowledge for her to eat. She remembered the story. She had to light a fire. She gathered up little sticks. She rubbed them together until a little spark appeared. She added more twigs and more sticks until now there was a fine flame on the fire. She put a stick through the fish on a spit, and she turned it slowly over the flames. And she smelt it as it cooked, and it smelt good. And when she felt it was ready, she broke a little piece and put it in her mouth. As soon as she tasted that salmon, her eyes began to sparkle, her head began to spin, her face began to glow with all the knowledge in the world that was flowing through her brain. She understood things she had never understood before. Languages from other countries, things way in the past and way in the future. It was so wonderful that she leapt up in the air in excitement. She leapt up so high that she landed splash in the well, and she sank down, 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 lower and lower and lower, down into the dark, deep waters of the well. And as she went down in the water, waves splashed over the wall and trickled down outside the well and down the hill. At first in a little trickle, and then some more water that flowed in a little stream that grew, and the little stream rushed faster as it bent around the stones, and it ran and it rushed and it rippled and it gurgled and it flowed and it grew, and it grew stronger and it grew longer, and it went faster, and it gushed and it rushed and it ran down the hill, and it ran past the town, and it flowed through the land, and it flowed into lakes and out the other side, and it gushed and it rushed and it ran and it flowed and it flowed and it kept flowing until finally, many, many miles later, it reached the sea. And that water started from the well and flowed through the land of Ireland all the way to reach the sea. That water is still here today. It is the longest and the strongest river in all of Ireland, the River Shannon. And the girl who was always asking questions, was never seen again. But the river was given her name. Shannon.
So here we are with some news for you for the world of writing. The first one is for students, and it's the International Student Play Script Competition. It's in its 36th year, which seems to be sort of a contradiction, students for 36 years. But anyway, it's the annual International Student Play Script Competition. It's a free-to-enter competition, and the winner receives a cash prize, which is currently £1,000 sterling. And a highly rated rehearsed reading at the British National Student Drama Festival at Sheffield in England next June 22nd to the 30th. Entry's free by post. Now here we go again. But an entry fee of £5 applies for emailed entries. So we're coming across this all the time now, people looking for more money for emailed entries. The competition has no restrictions on form, content, length, number of characters or locations, and there's no age limit or other restrictions. You need only be a student. No limit applies as to how many scripts any student can enter either. So the closing date for entries is not so far away. It's November the 30th of this year. November the 30th. And the website is isplayscript.org. isplayscript.org. So that's International Student Play Script.org. Or, as I was going to askaboutwriting.net, which is the resource site for this this programme. Just go on there, look for competitions, and go down to November, and you'll find it there. Just click on it, and it gives you a live link straight through to all of the information that we give you here on this programme. We can't do any better than that for you, other than to write the thing for you, but you better do that yourself. There's a competition in the short story field that's inspired by H.E. Bates, who was the Northamptonshire born master of the short story. Prizes are £150 sterling, 100 or £50. Entry fee is £4 per story, or £1 in the case of writers aged less than 18 years. The competition's open to all writers, and stories must be no longer than 2,000 words. The judging panel will be members of the Northampton Writers Group. And the organisers said they reserve the right to publish part or all of any of the entries in connection with the competition. Closing day for entries is not so far away either. It's December the 1st, 2011. December the 1st. And the website for this one is hebatescompetition.org.uk. So I'll spell it for you. hebatescompetition. And it's .org.uk. Again, askaboutwriting.net, have a look there under competitions, and have a look under in the December listings, and you'll see what they are. That's all we have for you this week in the line of competitions and opportunities. But if you have any luck or any success with anything that you hear on this radio programme, Telling Tales, broadcasting on West Dublin Access Radio from beautiful downtown Ballyfermot here in Dublin, you can give us a shout and we will celebrate with you. You can either come in and do an interview or just send us a note to say that this has happened. Our telephone number locally is 01 620 7139. 620 7139. Be the first to ring, be the first to be lauded on this programme, Telling Tales, programme for storytellers and writers. From myself, Brendan Nolan, for this week, and from Dave and Sound, it's goodbye for now, and keep writing. Bye bye. Slán.